On this episode of the London Lyceum, we talk with Dr. Daniel Peterson about Friedrich Schleiermacher. So we cover all sorts of topics like who in the world is this guy? What are his distinctive ideas? What are the general motivations for his thought compared to those who are thinking around his time? Have later Protestants appraised him fairly? Why would someone find his ideas desirable or appealing or convincing or potentially repulsive? How is he similar or different to more traditional Protestant thought? And much, much more.
As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, hit us up on Twitter or Facebook or check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com. Now for the only analytic, Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking.
Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. I am one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak, and we are a podcast that's dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church. And one way we've tried to explain that is to encourage and remind you of things like an intellectual culture, or creating an intellectual culture of sorts, things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. We think in our age, especially the internet age, there's far too little charity and curiosity in what other people think and why they think it. That includes living figures and dead figures. I mean, I find out all the time, you hear a trope about somebody long dead, and then you go read all their stuff and you realize that's actually not the whole story. I want to know more of the logic of why they're thinking it. And so I think there's a great virtue in a sort of healthy curiosity, not the vain curiosity that just seeks whatever for no good, but actually seeking sort of like the rationale for why people think the way they think. Because most of the time you'll find out, oh, there's actually reasons for why they think that. And we talk about a cheerful confessionalism and not just a confessionalism, because we think that confessionalism is more than just right doctrine. It's an entire posture toward what we'd think of as sound doctrine. So we think of that almost like as a mini culture itself. And I think too many guys especially are attracted to the sort of ideas of confessionalism because of the precision rather than the sort of like the charity that should be built into that. So they're just trading one fundamentalism for another. So we think of confessionalism in a cheerful sense to try to represent that it's calm and it's confident in its beliefs, and therefore it's unafraid to link arms with other Christians, and it's not afraid to sort of to spar in a healthy way with others who disagree. So that's a long way of introducing the show. I'm excited to talk to you guys, or talk to Daniel Peterson today, about Friedrich Schleiermacher. So I imagine a lot of you guys who listen, or women who listen, know of Schleiermacher, but probably don't have a good sense for like who he actually is, what he actually taught. I mean, if you read, 19th, 20th century, I guess, Reformed dogmatics like Hermann Bavinck, you see Schleiermacher all over the place. I've read Cory Brock's sort of Bavinck's usage and interaction with Schleiermacher, but I don't have any firsthand experience with him. So given his extreme downstream impact, I think the only thing I really know for certain is he talked about sort of like the feeling of absolute dependence. So this is going to be fun. Daniel, tell me a little bit about yourself. If you're a regular listener, you've already heard Daniel before talk about modal collapse, but give me that same bio again before we jump into thinking like, who is Schleiermacher? Why did you even care about him, sort of thing?
Yeah, I'm a theologian at the University of Aberdeen, research fellow in systematics, and I do Schleiermacher as my center and focus of my research, although many things reaching out from there. And that's one of the reasons I got interested in modal collapse questions and other sorts of stuff. And I do a lot of philosophical theology here.
Awesome. And if you don't know, I think Daniel's pretty cool. I think it's funny. I think we have differing intuitions on different things, but we really connect pretty well. I mean, we were talking for like 15 minutes before we even recorded this, just having fun talking about different stuff. And I think that's just so cool to be able to connect with people, and you have different intuitions on things, and yet you still have this sort of like connection. So I'm excited for this because I think it's going to be fun. A lot of these interviews, you can tell, I think, when you have, I know I'm just getting off topic here, but you can tell in different interviews, some people just really have the it factor sort of thing. And I think Daniel's one of those guys. So you should stay tuned for the whole thing is what I'm trying to tell you. So tell me a little bit about Schleiermacher. Who is he? Give me a little bit of his context so we can at least place that, because I know we do have listeners. Like my co-host Brandon asked you, his grandma is a faithful listener. She's probably going to have no idea who Friedrich Schleiermacher is.
Good. Well, I'll start off basic. Let me say for most of your listeners, he's just the bad guy. No, wait, hold on. I want to rewind. he's more complicated. I hope you stay tuned long enough to maybe at least hear why he's the bad guy, or may or may not be a bad guy. So he's known as the father of modern theology, or sometimes the father of liberal theology, or sometimes the father of modern Protestant liberal theology, or whatever, you know. But he's clearly a turning point in the history of theology. And you can't do theology after Schleiermacher without engaging him, I think. That doesn't mean agreeing with him, but you have to engage him. I had a supervisor, doctoral supervisor years ago, who used to say that Schleiermacher is one fire through whom every theologian must pass. And I do think that there's, like, for better or for worse, and I think mostly for better, he's worth engaging for people of a huge variety of interests. He will challenge, inspire, all sorts of stuff. And he's so everywhere that you don't know he's there. So basically the division of modern seminaries and universities, including not just in Europe, but especially in America, is basically his doing. So he invented the distinctions and divisions, you know, the biblical studies, historical theology, practical theology, all the kind of current and modern divisions. Those wouldn't have been found in a medieval university. And he basically puts those together as part of co-founding the University of Berlin. And you see the structure of the faculties and various other things at modern universities, including non-theological universities that take that form, the way that, for example, different disciplines relate to each other. You also see the emphasis on philology and a certain sort of historical critical study of the Bible to get at its meaning. So he's not going to be interested in the, at least not personally interested in the commitmentless historical study of the Bible. I mean, for him, that's a discipline of the church. But all those tools that you would have been taught, all the philology, he's going to be instrumental in that. Obviously, he's not the only person doing that, but he's one of the main figures popularizing it. He's as just a side job, he happens to be the premier German translator of Plato. So he's the Benjamin Jowett of Germany. If you read Plato in German today, you're still reading Schleiermacher's translation in most cases. Maybe in all cases, I can't remember. And he's still an authoritative secondary source in Schleiermacher. I mean, in Plato scholarship. So he's had this huge academic influence. He was also an enormously popular churchman at his time. So when he died, there were more than 100,000 people who attended his funeral. The city of Berlin shut down. The king lent dozens of his carriages, and he was given a royal burial. I mean, it's basically, imagine the death of a president or Martin Luther King Jr. or some enormous figure of social and political import. And he just did all this at the same time. So it's kind of this amazing multifaceted life where he brought together church life, academic life, and all sorts of facets of these, and the political considerations of how state and church might relate to academy and all of that stuff in a single life.
That's fascinating. I had no idea about any of that. So I, as you were talking, I recalled, which I don't know if this is accurate, so you tell me, Harry Emerson Fosdick, was he greatly influenced by Schleiermacher?
Yes. So that's where the strain of Schleiermacher that goes to 20th century or late 19th and 20th century liberal theology, it inspired a lot of these people. They're very often not inspired directly.
Okay.
But the very first works of Schleiermacher's to be translated into English were not his dogmatics, but his sermons, because he was known as an amazing preacher.
So I think those sort of things are, you know, we mentioned, is he the bad guy? I think a lot of people probably look at him as a bad guy, not because they've read a lot of him, but because of the people who are utilizing him in various ways. And I think of probably someone like Fosdick in my mind, at least in American context, is he's like a paragon villain of of traditional theology. And so is that a fair way of looking at Schleiermacher? Am I getting a truncated view, or is that really like a lot of what he's saying funneling there is correct? And the same thing with Bavinck, who's, to me, he seems to be critically appropriating Schleiermacher in some interesting ways. So he seems to be more appreciative of what he's doing. And so maybe in some ways, as his popularity grows, people might become less, hey, Schleiermacher's just a the total villain. Maybe he's sort of like a Jekyll and Hyde sort of situation. So I'd be curious, the interpreters that we're getting here, were because I, like, for me, you mentioned he's everywhere. I haven't really read a lot of him. So, like, I guess all the stuff I know of him is being interpreted from other people. So are these interpretations correct, close, off the mark?
So first, the historical bit. Basically, Schleiermacher has one real faithful student, Alexander Schweitzer. Not Albert Schweitzer, Alexander Schweitzer. And he's the last, basically the last actual Schleiermacherian. Then there's lots of ways in which Schleiermacher finds influence, but nobody signs up for the bulk of what he's up to after Schweitzer. Instead, what we get is later 19th century figures that are kind of inspired by him. So that'll include people like Fosdick, and that'll include people, like von Harnack, right? But von Harnack would never be Trelch, for example. But those folks are not dyed in the wool. They're not kind of towing any kind of party line. They're loosely associated or inspired, and they're often making decisions that are radically different than some of the decisions that Schleiermacher is going to make on key points. So basically, this is a game of telephone. You know, you was play in school where you'd kind of give a message and send it around the room, and by the time it gets back to you, it's almost an unintelligible or unrecognizable version of the original message. And it's for that reason, it's really worth actually reading the texts, which are enormously difficult. So a lot of people don't like to do it.
So von Harnack, you mentioned him. I think of him as like the generator of the Hellenization thesis. Is he getting that in any way from Schleiermacher, or is that his own doing?
I think he's getting that from instincts in the Reformation. So there are wings of the Reformation that are very grouchy about classical influences on the Christian tradition, and there's wings of the Reformation that are quite happy with those. So Luther sometimes is one way, sometimes the other, sometimes, you know, but at his grouchiest moments, he sounds like von Harnack. You might contrast it with somebody like Zwingli, who is, you know, in On Providence, he says, Moses and Paul, Plato and Seneca, these I summon as witnesses, right? He's including Plato and Seneca in the same list as Moses and Paul, right? So you get a very different feel depending on kind of which flavor of the Reformation you're getting. And it strikes me as a more distinctly, an idiosyncratic project that goes back quite a long ways, and probably further than that, probably, you know, all the way back to, you know, Tertullian, right? If we wanted to, you know, trace it all the way back. So
yeah, okay, got it. That's helpful. I've got an axe to grind against Hellenization thesis. I don't like it, but that doesn't mean that, you know, I like to be charitable to everybody. You know, I guess the instincts that are driving something like that. I think it makes sense. Like, we don't want to like allow different presuppositions to end up like corrupting the biblical witness. I just don't think that that's necessarily the case, but that's not the topic here. So let's talk. I mean, what distinctive ideas for Schleiermacher? The one I mentioned, I think earlier, the feeling of absolute dependence. I think that's the only one that I really know of, and it's probably, you know, that's just a catchphrase. So there's a lot of stuff going on there. So maybe you want to unpack that, or tell me about some other ones that I should be aware of or should know.
Yeah. So pulling back just a little bit, big picture wise. So there are these candidates for the ways of thinking about what piety is. So Schleiermacher is interested in piety first and foremost, rather than theology secondarily. He's going to get there, but first he's interested in piety. So what makes for a good Christian? He's going to call this piety. And by the way, he's following Calvin in doing this, right? And he thinks that, so he's going to give a summa pietatis, right? In along the lines of what Calvin will offer also. And by the way, he's a reformed theologian of a family of reformed theologians. And I mean, he's got, you know, perfect German reformed pedigree basically for a few generations. So, the candidates at his time are, you could be a Kantian and you can think religion is about ethics. And Schleiermacher says that this is characterizing a piety in terms of doing. Or you can be something more like a Hegelian and think religion is really about thinking. And then the best Christian is the person who's best at thinking. And so Schleiermacher characterizes these options as knowing, or as doing and as knowing. And he doesn't think that they're adequate. And he doesn't think that they're adequate because, on the one hand, the doing doesn't do justice to the way we suffer grace. So that kind of, he gets kind of Pelagian worries about that and various other things. And then on the thinking, he is worried about the elitism. So famously, and as an alternative, he says he locates this in feeling. Now, he goes on to give a technical definition of this instead, and I'll tell you about that in a second. But Hegel, in response, just to give you a flavor of this, Hegel, in response to Schleiermacher, they work at the same institution. Schleiermacher hires Hegel at the University of Berlin. So they're all kind of frenemies the whole time. And but Hegel, in response to Schleiermacher, says, well, Schleiermacher is right, the best Christian is a loyal dog. And Schleiermacher, in response, says, well, if Hegel's right, the best Christian is Hegel. And that is that's kind of the end of the argument, right? And like, we all know how absurd that is. And so, I mean, Hegel's theory, I mean, if you go into that piety consists in thinking, or, you know, or at least is centered on it, then the best Christian is the philosopher of religion. That's Hegel's account. Schleiermacher thinks, no, but what about the illiterate members of my congregation? Or what about the children? Or what about the people that are so wise but never had an education? Or what about the people that love God and their foolishness? Or all these examples that we know from our own congregational lives and other things. What about those people? No, piety must be something that's not either thinking or doing. It's got to lie in feeling. Now, he then gives a technical analysis of this. So he gives a kind of populist account or egalitarian account of piety, but then he gives a very strict account of how we ought to go thinking about it. So he's going to be quite tight argumentation in his theology in an attempt to justify a kind of broad view of who counts as a good Christian. And he defines feeling as a form of immediate self-consciousness. So it's not emotion. When you think feeling, most people go, oh, I feel sad, or I feel happy, or I feel down, or I feel elated, or whatever. He's not interested in that. That does connect to the immediate self-consciousness, but he's just saying, basically, people like to use the word feeling popularly. Let's say that, but what I really mean is immediate self-consciousness. Hmm. Immediate self-consciousness is consciousness that is not mediated. So it's not conceptually mediated specifically. So, and it's not objective. So you're not thinking about yourself as an object. It's kind of pre-critical consciousness. And he doesn't think that we have access to that kind of nakedly. He thinks it always comes packaged with moments, but it's what underwrites these moments. You might think of this as, I argue this interpretively for a variety of reasons, but you can think of it as a principle. Right, so it functions as a principle. It's not something that's it's not something that is made explicit. It's something upon which being made explicit depends. And when it's present actively, it's the first principle of our lives, and that he thinks is the life of spirit. So he thinks that this sort of awareness, this sort of awakeness, and he gives us examples of consciousness being awake or asleep. Or young children before they learn how to speak, right? So it's not something kooky. That doesn't have a wild view in mind. He literally means conscious or unconscious, right? So it's a kind of awakeness to God, is what he means, that underwrites the moments of our lives. That is then amenable to, inevitably, in fact, issues in both thoughts and deeds. And that is the subject matter that theology principally reflects upon.
So first, I think I sometimes forget all the giant Germans who are like alive in the same period of time and overlapping. And, you know, this, I guess that's just my own lack of historical knowledge or awareness to realize, wow, a lot of these great giants are like working together. So that's fascinating. Number two, it seems the way you've articulated this isn't as I guess bad as what in my mind a lot of people seem to like take to the conclusion of, okay, Schleiermacher says X, therefore he ends up sort of jettisoning like doctrinal convictions or beliefs sort of idea. Because it seems to me like what I hear in most climate, if somebody mentions Schleiermacher, it's to denigrate him as all he really cares about is just this feeling, this sort of like warm fuzzy, like authentic, you know, self-expression. I just feel God in this moment, to the denigration of all sorts of doctrinal content. And therefore, it doesn't matter what you believe.
all that matters is that you just have this internal, like, warm, fuzzy feeling. That doesn't seem to be what you're explaining here.
No.
Why is it that we've gotten this sort of picture of somebody like Schleiermacher?
There's a couple reasons. One is a link back in history to Charles Hodge and the Mercersburg School. So if folks are interested in that. So Charles Hodge is another kind of frenemy of Schleiermacher's. So he goes and studies with Schleiermacher and others in Berlin. He thinks that he has to do this to be a good theologian. And he disagrees with him his whole life. But he, by the way, Hodge has some of the best summaries of Schleiermacher's theology, in short, of anybody. I don't always agree, but they're so well done. They're impossible not to kind of find charming. And he's trying to do a really good job because Schleiermacher is genuinely his friend. And he has an entire section where he talks about, you know, critiquing Schleiermacher and then saying, but don't think for a moment that this guy's not in heaven. Right? This is after he's died. Right. Much of Hodge's argumentation is either borrowed from Schleiermacher or designed to thwart him. Same thing with Bavinck or with other figures that are going to borrow in part or, you know, take or leave a little bit. They feel like they have to argue because Schleiermacher's giving arguments. Nobody would have to say anything if he was not giving anything, if he wasn't offering anything persuasive. And the Christian faith, his dogmatics, is, you know, 700 plus pages of argumentation. That's a lot of argumentation and it's compact. It's not wasting a lot of time. So there's an awful lot to engage that's worth taking seriously. And in ways that, yeah, you might not like, that's fine. But he might teach you something even if by way of disagreement, because he wants to offer arguments and he thinks that you can be brought along or you could argue back. Like there's something very honest dealing about the whole thing.
So you mentioned figures like Kant and Hegel and others that he's sort of interacting with and thinking through. What is that main sort of motivating factor that's really driving him to say, let's develop this sort of understanding of theology?
Yeah, so one is a kind of contemporary crisis of authority, right? So people are wondering, you know, just saying the Bible's inspired. It may be true, but in a context where that's exactly what's being questioned, it's not helpfully reassuring. So Schleiermacher basically thinks the complaint is right, that you need to offer a better grounding. Not that you need to replace Scripture, but that you need to offer a better grounding for the reliability of Scripture. He actually has a fairly high doctrine of Scripture. It's worth reading. For example, he's a kind of inerrantist, but with a, you know, in a specific sense, right? Like he's going to offer this. So it's worth, just go read him before you get too grumpy. But he basically thinks, again, along the lines of Calvin, that Scripture is only Scripture if it's authorized by the Spirit, that it's actually the Spirit working in our hearts that makes Scripture Scripture for us. Otherwise, it's just, it's not authoritative for us. It's not yet inspired in a way that can become ours. And so kind of playing off of that Reformed heritage, sort of developing it, and also thinking about other kind of puzzles and problems along the way. For example, how one could possibly pray without ceasing, or various things along these lines. He develops this account of the immediate self-consciousness as essentially, by the time we get into the middle of the Christian faith, we learn that this is really just his way of talking about, in generalities, of talking about the work of the Holy Spirit. And he just thinks that that this is the presence of God communicated through the preaching of Christ that lives in us and informs our lives. And that Christ didn't have to be a, you know, grade A genius with an IQ of 200 to be the Son of God. And so neither do we. And there were many things that Christ did, but there were also some things that he failed to do in life, or not failed to do, but didn't do, that's what I mean. And so it can't just be all ethics all the time, or all human action all the time. That he did what was worthiest of him to do, but he didn't solve every little tiny problem of the world, and that wasn't his mission. And that doesn't have to be ours either.
So while I'm thinking about it, if somebody does want to pick up a copy of The Christian Faith, the best translation of that is, I mean, I just put it in Amazon to see what came up, and there's just one that's got a green cover.
Yeah.
Who is this?
H.R. McIntosh and J.S.
Yeah, so
Stewart.
That's the earlier translation, the first translation. It's fine. It's got some bits that are just completely an error. They're hostile translators, so that's actually helpful if you're a skeptic. So basically, they're giving you the least friendly version of the text to go with. And I think that's often maybe a good place to start for the kind of uncomfortable listener. Right. You can try the new translation as well. It's often very hard to find. It's also usually two or three times the price. And both translations have to make decisions about where to break up sentences because it's one of these early 19th century German texts which have individual sentences which run more than a page long. So
what, yeah. And do you remember offhand like some examples of these hostile decisions that are being made to give me an idea of like what they're, I guess, what translation decisions they're making?
I don't know if they're making bad translation decisions on because they're hostile, but I do know they're hostile. And you can read H.R. McIntosh's Types of Modern Theology and hear him kind of gripe about Schleiermacher in it. He has kind of gripey chapter. He's interested in reading Schleiermacher, but he's going to be kind of appreciative in certain respects, but he's not interested on the whole.
Got it. So when I think about Schleiermacher, if you're going to pitch him other than, you know, he's the guy that you've got to learn because everybody else being influenced him, what are the reasons that he's most appealing to either a theologian or potentially a churchman? What ways is he most convincing in making arguments? I'd be interested in hearing about that.
Yeah, so there's a whole bunch of reasons that may appeal to more people in different ways. What got me most interested in, but one of the centers of my interest are the ways he deals with problems in natural science. So his best friend, co-founder of the University of Berlin, is Alexander von Humboldt, who's like the German Darwin. And so he's thinking about contemporary scientific problems, both with respect to life and the life sciences, but also cosmology, fundamental forces, whatever. So if you're interested in thinking about how your faith can cohere with the discoveries in natural science, that's one of his main businesses. And it's not just natural sciences, it's also historical science. So for example, if you think, hey, I want to really be a faithful Christian, but I also want to take historical criticism seriously as a discipline, maybe not let it undermine my faith, but I want to add the two together, then he's the kind of person that could provide you an example, not the only way, but at least one example of how to do that successfully. So I think anyone with this kind of seminary training or similar, or you know, graduate training or even undergraduate training that gets into some of those details could find resources. In terms of content, I think it depends on the particular. And I think here it's better to kind of, you know, take what is helpful to you and leave what's less helpful. He's an enormously consistent, systematic thinker. He's probably the most self-coherent writer in the history of the church. So, and he's also, he's writing and arguing in a style which we wouldn't find as familiar, but if you read him carefully, you'll notice how powerful his arguments are. Even if you think he's wrong, he's never wrong for the first reason you think he's wrong. It's always one, you have to go a layer or two deeper to find where you think there may be a mistake or where you think you could really question a premise or a move of some sort. So I think he can teach you how to write a theology. He can teach you how to think theologically in a coherent way, but also how to argue about particulars.
Very cool. Now, I want to know, what are the main areas you would say that he is different than sort of the Protestant Reform stream that people might be familiar with, of things like the English variety that you find in Westminster, then you find in Savoy and other sort of streams that are more well developed than the early Reformation?
Yeah, good. So, I mean, the shortest way to describe Schleiermacher's program is that he's a 4-point Calvinist. He's just not going to have limited atonement. So he's going to end up being universalist or a very universalist friendly. Now, he does actually have an account of reprobation, but it's a temporary affair. So that will be controversial. But a lot of people find that
So like a universalist in the sense of literally like actually everybody gets saved, or like a hypothetical universalist where the atonement would save everybody if insert whatever clause.
So this is a point of some scholarly debate, but for tiny technical reasons, basically actual universalist.
Got it. Okay.
Absolutely. I mean, as he puts it, God sees everyone only in Christ.
Okay.
Right. So, and he thinks that this is effective and that this is a function of Christ's high priestly office. So the way he gets there is not by a kind of generic account of religion and it's all fine and it's all, you know, whatever. It's actually by a heavy duty monergism. Hmm. Right. So, you can see him using the machinery of the Reformed tradition to disagree with it in various respects.
So who is he drawing on to get to the more universalist approach or bent?
So again, because he's basically he's also a kind of part-time classics scholar, he's able to draw on all of the tradition, and he actively draws on all the fathers of the church going back to the beginning, and he cites them throughout the Christian faith, and you can tell that he's read them. And he's drawing on a whole bunch of other people that are more contemporary as well. So we know, for example, that he's reading, Gregory, right? and you know, these great patristic thinkers that end up saying something that sounds an awful lot like that too, you know. Or we know that he's reading Origen. We know that he's reading, a whole range of early Irenaeus, right? These are enormously important thinkers for him. So patristics and indeed both medieval and Reformation era scholastics are widely cited in the Christian faith as people he's engaging.
Got it. Now, how does someone like Barth end up utilizing or not utilizing Schleiermacher in his own program?
Yeah, so one of my friends put this well the other day, that Barth's thinking on Schleiermacher is great advice that Barth never took. Which is, Barth says, basically, you're not entitled to be grumpy at him if you haven't first appreciated him. The way he actually puts it is, you're not entitled to hate here if you haven't first loved here. And the person is not entitled to criticize here who's not prepared to love and love again. Now, does Barth execute? Probably not perfectly, right? But I do think, by the end of his life, especially, Barth saw that his program ended up looking an awful lot like more like Schleiermacher's than he thought. And I think the difference is because Barth was dealing with people influenced by von Harnack and Trelsch and others. He wasn't actually dealing with Schleiermacher.
Yeah. Okay. I think Kevin Hector does a lot of stuff on Schleiermacher. How would you differ in his approach to thinking about Schleiermacher? Are there unique emphases that you would say, I think he's a little bit off on this, or he's right on spot on this, and he's just really good, and I just haven't done a lot of work there?
Yeah, so I think that Kevin's vision of, I hate to speak for him, but I would just guess for a moment, I don't think he's trying to always be an interpreter of Schleiermacher, but a deployer of Schleiermacher. So how can I use Schleiermacher's insights to do some work, which I think is a noble thing and people should feel free to do it. It's slightly different than sort of trying to get Schleiermacher right. So his constructive projects, which I think are really interesting, are taking instincts in Schleiermacher's thinking and redeploying them. So for folks who don't know, Kevin wants to give a kind of Brandom-inflected, Wittgenstein-inflected account of a social practical account of doctrine, that allows us to both have a kind of consistency and revisability within what we're thinking theologically. I think that's right to a great degree with Schleiermacher. Schleiermacher really does read at many points like a kind of proto-Wittgenstein. So if you want a way of thinking about him, yeah, it's a little obscure, but Wittgenstein wasn't an idiot and, you know, did give arguments, even though he might have given them in ways that not everyone was giving them.
So given the influence of Schleiermacher, you know, you mentioned how he helped, I guess, co-found the University of Berlin. Are there other active institutions that sort of have the spirit of Schleiermacher still active? And because I think a lot of just most institutions have some sort of historical figure that's almost like driving their program from the dead in some sense. So I'd just be curious, like, who is still trying to execute in that sort of vision?
So I don't know if that there's not an institution whose branding reflects Schleiermacher in quite the same way. But I do think that besides all the kind of institutions that have been associated, I mean, Schleiermacher is widely studied in Germany, as you might not be surprised to learn, but mostly not as a theologian, mostly as a philosopher or a philologist or a politician or a hermeneuticist. Oh yeah, Schleiermacher invented the discipline of hermeneutics. I mean, he coined it. Obviously, people were interpreting things before that. But Schleiermacher coins hermeneutics and writes the first book called Hermeneutics about hermeneutics. So if you're ever interested in interpretation, you might find him, interesting. But there's people that are interested in these auxiliary areas theologically of Schleiermacher's. The English-speaking world does more on the theology proper. And probably the best place in the world right now to do it is Aberdeen. So I have 4 or 5 colleagues that do something Schleiermacher related. I mean, that are significant, who are significant Schleiermacher scholars doing something Schleiermacher related. And including Bruce McCormick, who we've recently brought on board. So we've got a pile of really kind of a great concentration. Now, many of them are actually Bardians. Right, that's their sort of day job, is to be Bardians. And so I think that tells you something about the Bardians who went and actually read this and were like, oh, hold on, this guy was supposed to be the enemy, but as soon as I keep reading, I discover something different than is necessarily being reported.
Yeah, interesting. So you mentioned in an email to me about him and his thoughts on modal collapse. So if you've listened to the episode, then you've got a good context for that. If you haven't, then I just say go listen to it and then come back to this one and you can keep up with the conversation. I'd be curious, did you say to me, I can't recall, that he would say, yeah, modal collapse, that's it. It is what it is. Who cares?
It's not just that who cares. He wants it. And he wants it not to get rid of simplicity. He wants simplicity to get a modal collapse.
Why?
Because he thinks that once we learn what God is determinately in history, in the revelation of Christ, that the only way we know who God is necessarily is if we know that God couldn't have been or done otherwise, and not in any other sense otherwise. So the Christian faith concludes with the doctrines of wisdom and love. And with a modal collapse, you get a state where, or you get a set of circumstances where for any truth, it's contradiction, or it's contrary implies a contradiction in just the same way as a triangle with 4 sides is a contradiction. And he wants to conclude the Christian faith by saying that God is love and its opposite implies a contradiction. So to think that God is not love is like thinking of a square circle.
So couldn't someone, though, say, well, yeah, I'm fine with that. Like, I want to say that God's nature is necessary, but that still gives me some level of, like, I could still pick between chocolate ice cream and strawberry ice cream, and that wouldn't have any bearing on God being loving in any sense.
Yeah, so, you know, maybe. I mean, there are certain choices which would surely have a bearing on God, on God being loving. For example, if you pick the strawberry ice cream to give to your friend who's allergic to strawberry ice cream, you might not be the sort of person who could be described as loving anymore. So there's going to be a whole range of choices and a whole range of, I mean, Schleiermacher thinks the object of election is the universe, which includes Christ and everything else. So he thinks that this is one conceptually enwrapped whole. So he's going to subscribe to a heavy-duty version of the doctrine of conceptual containment.
What is the doctrine of conceptual containment?
So basically, he's going to refuse the distinction between an analytic and a synthetic truth. For example, this comes out of a long tradition, but including especially people like Leibniz are famous for it. So Leibniz says in his dispute with Arnauld, who's the Jansenist, Arnauld says to Leibniz, "Hey, I could have been born in Lyon, and that wouldn't have been made a big difference." And Leibniz responds, if you were born in Lyon, you would not have been Arnauld. So who it is to be you, your individuation and identification, are specified by the totality of all the predicates that it could ever be applied to you. which include all your relations to everything in the universe and God. So this is a solution, by the way. This is how you can get out of hexaity stuff. So you don't have to talk about there being a thing that makes me, that's a secret hidden thing, if you can have a person be kind of exhaustively triangulated by all these predicates and relations.
I mean, isn't that in some sense like a version of like a myriological essentialism, where like literally everything's necessary for your personal identity?
Yeah.
Which to me, that just seems deeply unintuitive.
I don't know how many arguments from intuition are there. I think that the arguments are the intuitive parts of the brackets that we find intuitive that God is love, and that we are immediately self-conscious of depending on God absolutely. Now, as soon as we recognize that we depend upon absolute God absolutely, we recognize we don't depend upon anything else, and that God is a sort of self-explaining explainer. And then we've got a kind of heavy-duty version of monotheism up and running. And from that, Schleiermacher is going to follow much of the classical tradition and think that just entails simplicity.
So on this account, then, it seems like creation is necessary.
Necessary and free. So Schleiermacher is going to go straightforwardly with Spinoza on this.
Okay.
And Spinoza's argument is really fun in these conversations, because Spinoza thinks that actually God is only free if what God does is necessary. Because the contrary of it is that either God's will is turned by something external, or that God's will is inessential and therefore not properly God's. So the only way for those two problems to be avoided is if God's will is just God's essence, and that will is as absolutely necessary as God's essence. And in debating some of the modal collapse stuff, I've gone to some length to pointing out ways I'm not quite sure they land their punches quite yet. One of the ways critics of simplicity might do that more is by trying to argue against the distinctions of things that are conceivable in themselves. Schleiermacher, following Spinoza on this point, thinks that things are not conceivable in themselves apart from God. So that basically, if you want to understand absolutely anything, you have to understand it under God as a first principle, and then go down the kind of conceptual ladder. And by the way, that's exactly what Plato teaches. So it's not just Spinoza. You can find this in lots of accounts, right? This is the unhypothetical first principle stuff. So once you think that, and you think you have to, in order to understand something, you have to understand the things in which it is conceptually contained, then I think you do have a way of talking about, a way of arguing successfully that the modalities can become completely transitive. Hmm. On the other hand, Spinoza and Schleiermacher both are going to just say, well, that's it, but that's immaterial for the question that theologians are worried about, which is dependence. So actually, everybody's been worried about alternatives, but what we really care about is relations of dependence, and those are entirely independent of questions of modality, of questions at least of the logical necessity stuff. So it's just all a red herring, and he's delighted to have the positive consequences and doesn't really mind at all to have the negative consequences. In fact, he wants them, but what others see as the negative consequences, they're part of his positive consequences.
So this is all fascinating, and I want to go back a little bit to the universal question, or universalism, just because I know that's going to be probably the main pain point.
Fair enough.
People who listen to this podcast anyway. And would he be fine? I mean, is it just like, yeah, universalism's true? And I think some people might go to something like the Apostles' Creed and say, you know, an article of the faith is, you know, the resurrection of the body, the life everlasting, forgiveness of sins. And I guess, is he just going to interpret that? Here it is. For there he will come to judge the living and the dead. And I guess, well, maybe is the interpretation just like, yeah, he's going to do all that. It's just everybody's going to have everlasting life in heaven. And
well,
that's
yeah, I mean,
that.
First of all, let me just backtrack for just 2 seconds about the necessity stuff, just to say one last, because I realized there was one thing I forgot to say, which is just that notice that the account Schleiermacher is giving is the hardest-nosed account of election one could possibly give. Right. So instead of thinking of him as a kind of a wimpy, feelingsy guy, you can actually think of him as a kind of reformed thinker turned up to an 11, right? I mean, in some ways, what he's doing is turning up the stakes and turning up the volume. So it's worth noting the continuities here, even as some of the decisions might strike us as odd.
Well, now all my Arminian listeners just threw Schleiermacher in the trash.
Well, but that's the great thing is he makes no one happy because he's just not pinnable, right? Like, so everyone thinks, oh, yeah, this guy's a kind of proto-process guy. Ooh, oh, honey, you know, wait till I break it to you, right? Or whatever, right? Like, so you, but but he's going to agree with Wesley, by the way, on the universal scope of atonement, right? And he grew up with Moravians, who are the same people that got Wesley to convert, right? So there's a direct lineage to both Reformed and Wesleyan traditions that kind of dovetail in him. But he's going to have a Calvinist doctrine of election with a Wesleyan doctrine of atonement, and that'll make maybe no one happy, but at least you can see the appeal, or you can see the reasoning, right? How you were talking about to judge the living and the dead. So some sort of, let's just pick a kind of generic kind of Orthodox Reformed thinker. They think that we are, that Christ is judged in our place, and that the way we are to endure the judgment of God is by the vicarious judgment that carried out in history and then in the last judgment finalized in Christ in our place. So all you have to answer that question is to repeat the answer. Schleiermacher can say something very similar, right? And indeed, anybody who wanted to open. And this is exactly why, by the way, Zwingli is tempted to be a universalist in his writings, because he reads once for all, and he has this doctrine of election. He's got this once for all stuff, and that sounds an awful lot like, you know, that's where the road may lead you. Now, again, as I've said, though, Schleiermacher is not kind of... he's less clear about where he wants to land on all this than about the problems with landing elsewhere. So there is a debate about it, but I think it's pretty clear. So
that makes sense. So then what does he do? I don't want to spend, we haven't spent all our time on this, so I don't mind asking. What does he do with all the texts where Jesus is talking about, you know, hell? Is he saying, well, no, that's just a metaphor, or is that, you know, it's really a place, but no one goes there? What's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, he's pretty brisk about dealing with the texts in the Christian faith. So he'll deal with them in commentaries or in other places. But he just thinks that they do not require you to think that this is a place of eternal conscious torment. Okay. And he thinks that annihilationism is barely any help. Like, maybe it's better than hell, but meh. Right? Like, that actually most of the in-principle objections to hell apply to annihilationists. That's more humane, no doubt, in some ways. I mean, people kind of, you know, obvious, it's kind of but many of the in-principle objections to hell apply to annihilationists, except that annihilationists lose out on on a certain sort of divine justice, right? So there are trade-offs, and he's just going to think that that's not particularly appealing. He gives a really interesting argument about this, which you'll find, I believe, repeated in David Bentley Hart. Maybe that's another point at which listeners turn off the show, but it, just so you know, people borrow these arguments. You'll hear them around. It's worth knowing, even just to get the joke, where they come from. So Schleiermacher gives an argument against hell from sympathy, and the argument is this: he thinks that Christian redemption has content, that it means something. And part of the content of it is greater and greater love for all people. And he thinks that in heaven, that content will be perfected. So that we have maximal neighbor love, right? The maximal love for all people. And this issues, or takes the form of maybe, sympathy. So weep with those who will weep, rejoice with those who rejoice. And therefore, the joy of others in heaven will add to our joy. But conversely, the sufferings of anyone would detract from our joy as we shared in their suffering. Because so this is going to be where he, for example, really parts ways with someone like Aquinas, who thinks that part of the joys of heaven is getting to watch the sufferings of the damned, right? Which is a kind of strong counter view. And he thinks, no, that actually basic, he thinks that because our sympathies, our love wraps up our good with others, that we can't enjoy heaven while anyone else is in hell. And that if anyone were to be in hell, therefore, we would all be. If we were in fact redeemed, our greater love for all people would result in increasing suffering over eternity as they were not happy. And you might not think that's right, but it's sure food for thought, I think. And it would be interesting to think why it's wrong, right? Just as a pedagogical exercise. Okay. Yeah. And I think it's challenges that it kind of cuts to such a basic claim and what we might think would be such a natural entailment of neighbor love.
I mean, I guess my natural gut reaction at that point is to say, well, let me point out the extreme cases where it seems like there's a pretty solid, like the Hitlers of the world. We don't like them. They seem to have like gone beyond sort of like a, I don't know, where Paul, he talks about like in 1 Timothy 1, where he's talking about like this sort of like obstinate sort of characteristic. And I think he talks about somewhere else where I think people would say, well, there must be some like line where once you cross it, then you're outside the pale. And if you admit of that scenario, then it seems like you've opened the floodgates to the whole thing. And the sort of idea would have some incoherence somewhere within it.
Yeah. So that's a great, kind of, test case, right? Yep. And that's exactly where Hodge ends up having to go, because he's hugely persuaded by Schleiermacher's argument, but is like, but you know, not Hitler, because he's not a time, because Hodge is not a time traveler, but there are cases of egregious evil, right? And Hodge ends up saying at the end of his systematics that the number of the finally damned will be just impossibly small. So he's gonna be a predestinarian, but he just thinks that the number of people in hell is like there's 10 of them, like Hitler, Stalin, Pol Pot, right? You know, or whatever, and that's it, right? Like he's got, you know, and but that's part of Hodge's response to this argument from Schleiermacher, because he kind of feels the moral force, but he can't say no. These huge baddies just kind of get away with it. Schleiermacher's here is going to go more with the patristics. So, but he's going to offer a kind of, he's kind of vague about it, but it's sort of like a Protestant purgatory, or it doesn't have to be over time, right? It's not like another realm you have to sort of travel through. Don't think Dante here, but like the idea is back to the kind of patristic notion of you'll be stripped of evil, and the more evil you are, the more painful that will be. You'll be made good, and it might not be fun at the moment being made good for the most evil.
Yeah, well, this is fascinating. So, yeah. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me about this. Remind me where listeners can go to keep up with your work. I know you mentioned you're at Aberdeen, so maybe the website there is the best place to go.
Yeah, and I have a couple books. One of them is Silly Expensive from a German press on Schleiermacher on God and Natural Science. But your library could probably get it, or various things like that. If you have a theological library, it's exactly the sort of thing that they would carry. And then also I have another book out, Schleiermacher's Theology of Sin and Nature, on Schleiermacher's very controversial and I think really interesting account of sin and sin's origins and evil. So it directly relates to this. And that's out in paperback for kind of a relatively humane, I don't know, $35 or something like that, depending on where you can find it. So those are the main things. And, you know, we're around and look us up. We're always doing interesting things in theology at Aberdeen. And not everyone agrees with me here. So if you don't like this, don't foreclose on the department.
Well, two things. Number one, if you're listening, I'll make sure to link to the books in the show notes so you can just click the button and it'll take you right there to Amazon or wherever, and you can buy the books from wherever you prefer to buy them. I know a lot of you nerds don't like to go to Amazon because you don't want to support the big box, whatever. But there's also the reality of, yeah, I like the two-day shipping and the cheap prices. So it's that double-edged sword, because all the people who like to buy these sort of books don't make money. The second thing I want to mention is I love UK programs because there really is a lively sort of intellectual culture. Every institution I've been at has this same sort of ethos. I don't know what it is. So yeah, I think having been to Aberdeen, though I went to Scotland once, and it was freaking awesome. So if anything is like Edinburgh, then, you know, I'm a Scotland believer. So just I would recommend going and checking it out.
Yeah, well, we encourage people who are interested to, you know, look our way. We have a lot of great stuff happening here.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I think one of my favorite professors, I think Jonathan Pennington, I think he went to Aberdeen. Maybe he went to St. I get confused of Aberdeen or St. Andrews. You know, I'm going to Google it right now while we're here on the show before I forget, because Google's amazing. You can probably hear me type. And let's click before we close up. Dr. Pennington, he went to St. Andrews. Dang it. Okay, well,
no one's
close
perfect.
Enough. Yes, the mistake is mine. Still,
but we
work
great with our colleagues around, and I mean, Scotland's a big country, a beautiful place, but kind of a small place in terms of people. I mean, it's about the population of Greater Houston, so
that's wild.
So it's easy to get to know people all over the country.
Very cool. Well, I appreciate you, Daniel, taking the time to talk with us about this. I do commend you all to check out the resources.
Thanks,
and
Jordan.
As you know, you've been listening to the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet, and we'll talk to you guys soon.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.